Today, we are going to start a new series called Salt and Light, and I believe it is going to shape the arc and trajectory of the Solid Rock story for years to come. The series comes out of Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, also known as the Sermon on the Mount, well done, which puts the central teachings of Jesus in one place. And that said, please turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 4. We're going to rewind back a few verses, get the context. And after that, the plan for today is to move into the Sermon on the Mount, get into what Jesus means by salt and light, and then announce three changes we feel God is calling Solid Rock to step into, three tectonic shifts in how we feel God is calling Solid Rock to do church. That said, Matthew 4, are you ready? Anybody else? Yes, new series, fall is in the air, scarves are 2 weeks away, Jesus is back from the dead. But in a different order of importance, okay? Matthew 4, here we go. Jesus went throughout the Galilee, up in the north part of Israel, teaching in their synagogues, or kind of first century church buildings, proclaiming the good news or the gospel of the kingdom. Remember from last week, the kingdom is the inbreaking rule and reign of the Creator God over the earth. The king's presence as he returns and breaks back into human history in Jesus of Nazareth. And he starts to bring humans from all over the planet back into a relationship with the living God. And Jesus goes proclaiming the good news of the kingdom. And not only that, but healing every disease and sickness among the people. Meaning Jesus is loving people, serving people, and out of that, sharing the gospel or the good news of God's inbreaking kingdom with the world. Now, news gets out, 24. News about him spread all over Syria, way past the Galilee, and people brought to him all who were sick with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Broken people, cripples, demoniacs, people from, in that day, the margins of society, way before it was hip to take care of the broken. In Jesus' day, the broken people are angry with cripples and the sick and demoniacs. God is angry with people like that was the mentality. But Jesus, and I quote, healed them. Now, large crowds, we think tens of thousands of people from the Galilee, a very Jewish area, a very religious area, a very hyper-conservative right-wing area, synagogue-centric area, and look at the next line, the Decapolis, which is nearby, but is a very non-Jewish area, a very Roman area, very Greek area, made up not of kind of right-wing conservative religious people, but left-of-center progressives, hedonist pagans who don't know Yahweh from Zeus, right? Made up of people nothing like the Jews. The Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, urbanites from down in the south, Judea from all over, and the region across the Jordan, and the actual Greek here is mishmash, right? People from all sorts of backgrounds, and I quote, followed Jesus. The crowd is made up of an eclectic, random grouping of men, women, Romans, Greeks, Jews, religious people, pagans, sick, healthy, demoniacs, synagogue leaders, all backgrounds come in front of Jesus. Now, if you know anything about the first century context Jesus speaks the Sermon on the Mount into, you know there would have been people in that crowd, very religious people, the kind of people who were in the synagogue every Sabbath. and who were in the Torah every single day. And there would have been people like that, the religious people, who were taught from a young age, stay away from those people. The Decapolis people, the Romans, the Greeks, the demoniacs, the cripples, the sick. God is, stay away from those people. There would have been Jews, young and old, in the crowd who were taught from birth for decades. Hey, listen, the way you stay holy is you stay away. The way you stay holy is you stand at arm's length, far away from broken people, from non-Jewish people, non-religious people who don't know Yahweh, don't follow God. Stay away from people like that. Now, here's the problem. God shows up, calls himself Jesus, and he breaks all the rules. And Jesus comes near to those people. And Jesus is holy, absolutely, top to bottom, but he's shoulder to shoulder with those people. Not only with the religious people, not only with the nice, tuck your shirt in, go to church every Sunday, but with those people. Jesus rubs shoulders. He comes close, and watch what happens. Chapter 5. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, his disciples. Now, the way Matthew tells the Jesus story, he breaks the crowd into two groupings. You have the crowds at large. Notice the language, crowds, plural, because all sorts of backgrounds and different sorts of people. And then you have the disciples. Now, the word disciples in Greek is mathetes. Can you say mathetes? Right, and the disciples were not only like the 12 dudes, Peter, James, and John, but were a grouping of men and women, we don't know how many, who were followers of Jesus. The word mathetes literally means learners or apprentices. The disciples were people who would wake up every morning and apprentice under Jesus, the rabbi, prophet, Messiah from Nazareth, apprentice to learn Jesus' way, learn Jesus' theology, how Jesus reads Torah, learn how Jesus operates, become like Jesus, think like Jesus, talk like Jesus, love like Jesus, serve like Jesus, preach like Jesus, and one day carry on Jesus' life into the world. Disciples. Now, Jesus teaches what today is called the Sermon on the Mount. In Jesus' day, it was not called that. It was called Jesus is up on a mountain teaching, right? But he teaches to his disciples because the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' manifesto for the kingdom of God. The sermon is how disciples of Jesus live in community and on mission. 99% of the sermon is all about relationships. We are going to get into that. All about what today is called community. He's forming what is later called the church. And Jesus teaches his disciples, his learners, his apprentices, his followers. But here's what you need to get. In earshot of the crowds, tens of thousands of people listen, and the way the sermon functions, it's a manifesto. Here's how disciples live under the rule and the reign of the living God, and it's a standing invite to anybody and everybody. Religious, pagans, Jews, Greeks, Romans, Portlanders, cripples, healthy people, fitness trainers, and everything in between. It's a standing invite wherever you are at, wherever you come from. Jesus invites you into the kingdom of God. Jesus invites you, fill your name in the blank, to come under God's rule, come under God's reign, live in God's presence as a learner or an apprentice to God among man called Jesus and learn the path to life. Now, what happens is Jesus gets into the sermon. We're going to take the next 3 or 4 months to unpack Jesus' sermon per se. But one of the problems is it's well known, right? Everybody's a fan of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Gandhi's a fan, all of that. fine and well, but the problem is we lose how shocking Jesus' sermon was. We lose how subversive the teacher from Nazareth really was. For starters, let's read the first part of Jesus' sermon, verses 3 to 12. Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Now you need to get, in today's language, thousands of years later, we manipulate Jesus' words into being a good thing. Well, the poor in spirit or people who really get, you know, blah, blah, blah. Listen, in the first century, nobody would have read that as a good thing. Nobody. Poor in spirit can be translated spiritual zeros, spiritual incompetence. The idea in Jesus' world was people with nothing to offer at all. And Jesus opens, not with abstract ethics about how you get along with your wife or how you, you know, grow your business, five steps to it. No, Jesus opens with, "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are people with nothing to offer." And he goes on, "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of the heavens. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be what? Glad, because great is your reward in the heavens. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Now, there is so much here. We are going to circle back in a few weeks to the Blesseds, also known as the Beatitudes, and unpack Jesus' words in depth in about 3 or 4 weeks. Here's all you need to get for today. Two things. First, the English word blessed does not capture what Jesus is saying. Other translations have happy, that's worse, or fortunate, which, okay. But in Jesus' world and language, it's more like God is with you. Or God's saving, gracious rule and reign is coming over your life. It's closer, I would argue, to the English word salvation. Blessed. God is with you. God's kingdom is coming over you. God's salvation is covering your life. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then Jesus dumps out a laundry list of undesirables, mourners, people who are hungry and thirsty, dirt poor, nothing to offer, people oppressed by the powers on the earth, the exact opposite of the religious people of Jesus' day. And the king, here's the point, the kingdom of God is coming upon those people. Wait a minute. The kingdom is for religious people, right? The kingdom is for people who tuck the shirt in and show up on time, right? Yes, and the kingdom of God is for the people at the end of chapter 4. The sick, the ill, the demoniacs, people from the Decapolis and the Galilee, Judea, all over. The kingdom of God is for those people. Blessed, Jesus says. Now, the second thing you need to get is that when Jesus says, when he stands up on the side of a hill and he says to the disciples and to the crowds, blessed, he is telling a story. What story? The Israel story. In fact, he's telling one of the most important passages in the scriptures. Here's the passage from Genesis 12. Jesus is retelling years later. Genesis 12, Yahweh had said to Abram, also known as Abraham, leave your country, your people, and your father's household and go to the land I will show you. Now, what comes next is called the covenant, or in today's language, the promise made by God to Abraham and out of that Israel. I will make you into a great nation, and I will what? Bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a what? blessing. And he repeats and rephrases, I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be what? Blessed through you. And if you know the story, Genesis 12 speaks into it. At that point, the world is a wreck, fractures into pieces because of sin. The nations are far from God, disconnected from the Creator, disconnected from life as God intended. And how is God going to save the world? Genesis 12 says through Abraham and later through Israel. But from the beginning of time, God says, I will bless you and you will be a what? Blessing. The point of Israel was never Israel. She was always a means to an end. The end was God saving the world. And God does that through Abraham's family, through Israel. You need to get that. As followers of God, years later, you are not an end. Solid Rock is not an end. We are a means to an end. You are conduits for God to work through in order to put the world back together. Now, Jesus retells the Abraham story. Jesus stands up. And there are all sorts, by the way, of Israel overtones. Moses goes up on a mountain. Jesus goes up on a mountain. Moses gives the Ten Commandments. Jesus gives the Ten Blesseds. Moses speaks over 12 tribes. Jesus speaks over 12 disciples. Moses comes out of the desert. Jesus comes out of the desert. All sorts of stuff we don't have time to get up to. But Matthew, who writes the story, is genius. And he's writing about Jesus, who is brilliant, right? But long story short, what Jesus is doing here when he opens the sermon on the side of the hill is he is saying the Israel story is reaching its climax in me. I am doing what Abraham was supposed to do. I am doing what Israel was supposed to do. And if you know the Israel story, did Israel succeed or fail? Fail. I am doing what Israel was supposed to do. I am bringing God's blessing, God's presence, God's saving rule and reign back to the world. Amazing story. But here's what's crazy. As Jesus stands up on a mountain like Moses, he calls 12 disciples and he forms a community to join with Jesus as he brings the Israel story to its climax. And look what Jesus says to the community. 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Jesus, like I said, forms a community of disciples to join in the Israel story around himself. And Jesus uses two metaphors for how disciples of Jesus are called to live. Salt and what? Light. First, Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. You, followers of Jesus, you disciples, apprentices, you are like salt. Now, salt does three or four things, right? Salt brings flavor and taste. Am I right? Like if it doesn't taste good, you say more what? More salt, right? Because without salt, it's bland, no flavor. Salt brings out what's already latent. Salt brings life. Secondly, salt keeps things from going bad. In the ancient Near East, salt was used as a preservative more than anything, right? Long before the days of frigid air and the freezer in the back of your garage, right? Salt keeps things from going bad, but here's one of my favorite things salt does. Salt makes people thirsty. Am I right? You eat something salty and you need a drink of water. Jesus says that is how followers of Jesus are called to live. In such a way that you bring the flavor and the taste of Jesus everywhere you go. You walk into a house or a coffee shop or a gym or a restaurant or a meeting or a cubicle station, and you bring the flavor of Jesus. the mood changes. It's like the gospel of Jesus shows up and he looks a lot like my coworker Bob. You bring flavor, you bring influence. Secondly, we are called to live in such a way to keep the world from going bad. You are a preservative in the culture or in the city. Lots of different opinions in the church, but how we flesh that out. One group says from the top down, power, politics. Another group says, no, from the outside in, retreat, subculture, reach in, pull people out once in a while. I would argue it's neither. It's from the inside out, where you live in the culture, in the city. You rub shoulders like Jesus with people far from God. And because of your presence, you keep the world from going bad. But last, my favorite one is we are called to live in such a way we make people thirsty. People look at your life. People get thirsty for more. You have no idea how often I hear people come in who are new to Jesus. And I say, okay, how did you get to Jesus? How did you get to the gospel? How did you get here to the church? You have no idea how often I hear, well, I know a guy who goes to Solid Rock. And I saw always the same story. I saw something different in him. Well, my college kid, you know, she goes to church here and follows Jesus. And I saw something different in her. Well, yeah, you know, my neighbor is, you know, he goes, and I saw something different in him. You have no idea how often. You are an incredible community of Jesus followers. I love you and respect you. You have no idea how often I hear people praise you. You are called to live like that. We are called to live in such a way you make people thirsty because you are like salt, which is why Jesus says, okay, warning, don't lose your saltiness, because we all lose saltiness, am I right? Don't lose your effect, your flavor, your taste, your influence, your presence. Salt and light are agents of influence. You introduce salt or light into, and it changes the environment. Don't lose your saltiness, Jesus says. You are the salt of the earth. Now, next, Jesus says, you are the light of the world. A town built on the side of a hill cannot be hidden. Now, please understand, those are not two separate metaphors, but one. The imagery is of the lights of a city up on the side of a hill, late in the middle of the night, that shines out into the darkness. Imagine the world in the first century, long before halogen street lamps, right, and headlights on cars and reflective tape on the side of the road and the double yellow line on the asphalt. You were a dude out in the middle of the desert on a camel, right? And it's dark outside, and there are robbers, and there are thieves, and there are animals all over the place, and you are scared, and you are nervous, and you need safety, and off in the distance, you see a glow. And you know that glow. That glow is a city. That glow is the light from not one, not two, but 10, 20, 1,000, 10,000 lights all together in one place. And it shines and radiates out into the darkness. We think you could see the city lights in the first century from hundreds of miles away in the desert. And the light draws you and pulls you in. The light leads you and guides you into the city. And Jesus says that is how followers of Jesus are called to live. You, and by the way, the word there is plural. Not you as in John Mark or Alex or Dave, but you as in Solid Rock, Church of God in Portland. You are the light of the world. All together in one place, you shine in Jesus' language and you radiate and you glow out, and people from a long ways off, people far from God, see the life of the living God at work in how you live and are drawn in to the city of God. Now, here's what you need to understand about the second metaphor, the light of the world. It's not random. It's not like Jesus, well, what is the church like? Light, right? But it comes out of the story of God. In particular, it comes from the prophet Isaiah, who over and over says to Israel, you are the light of the world. Here's one passage, one example out of Isaiah 42. I, Yahweh, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand, Israel's hand in context. I will keep you and will make you to be a covenant. Remember the language? What's that? Genesis 12, covenant, promise. I will bless you. You will be a what? Blessing. I will take you into that story. For who? Right there, people. Covenant for the people. The point of Israel was never Israel. She was always for the world and a light for the Gentiles, for non-Jewish people. Isaiah speaks when Israel flat out failed at being the light of the world. And he says, you know what? I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring you back to my intent, what I intended in the beginning, Genesis 12, blessed to be a blessing. And you are going to be the light of the world. When Jesus stands up on the side of a hill, it's not random. He says, you are the light. That's a metaphor for Israel. Then he says, a town built on the side of the hill. That's a metaphor for, anybody know? Jerusalem. Well done. Thank you. Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the capital city, the focal point of the Israel story, is literally a town built on the side of a hill. I was there last year, and the entire city is on a hill. There's not one flat spot in the entire city. You live in Jerusalem, you have good calves, right? At the top of the city is the Temple Mount, where God's temple was. That's why when you read in the scriptures, it's called Mount Zion, because it's up on a mountain, right? A town built on the side of the hill in first century language was Jerusalem. Jesus is saying to his disciples, men, women, Jews, non-Jews, motley crew from all sorts of backgrounds, you are the new Israel, you are the new Jerusalem. The Israel story is reaching its climax in me and my life and my work, and I'm calling you to join in the Israel story with Jews to be a blessing to the world. You, Jesus says, are salt and light. Now, here's what you need to get about salt and light. Salt and light are opposite metaphors. Not parallel, not two different ways of saying the exact same thing. Think about it. Salt is only good spread out. Am I right? Like, when was the last time you had a bowl of salt for breakfast? Right? Or a salt burrito, right? But no guacamole today, right? Salt is only good spread out, scattered in clusters or granules. Jesus says, you are like salt. You're only good spread out. Light, on the other hand, the kind of light Jesus talks about, the lights of a city in the middle of the night to help people find the way in, is only good all together in one place, right? One light or two or three all by itself or 20 from 100 miles away, who cares? It's nothing. But you put 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or millions all together in one spot, well, that really kicks it into gear. Light is only good gathered all together in one space. Well, okay, wait a minute, Jesus. Are you saying, how should we live as disciples? How should we do church? Should we live like salt scattered out into the city, spread out all over in small clusters? Or should we live like the light of the world, gathered together in large gatherings with thousands of people in one place to shine out into the world? Well, which one? Yes, both and, absolutely. It's a both and, salt scattered, spread out, light gathered together all in one place. Here's the problem. You may or may not agree, but I would argue, and I'm almost always right, or always right, I'm fine with that as well, but let's go with almost today. I would argue when you think about the church in the United States, or when you think about churches like Solid Rock, and you think about the polarity of kind of the gathering light of the world weekend thing you are at right now, and then you think about the scattered salt of the earth, house churches, people, relationships thing, I would argue we are way better at gathering than scattering. We are way better at being the light of the world than being the salt of the earth. We are way better at what happens here on the weekends for 2 hours than what happens for the other 166. Would you agree with that? You may not, but I would argue when you think about the dual calling of Jesus on the church, salt and light, light part, we're doing okay, right? We are doing okay. I think the gatherings are well done for the most part. In America, we have churches with buildings. We have air conditioning. We have computers that check in your children, right? We have free coffee out in the foyer. We have seats for some of you. If not, 8 a.m., Jesus is on the move. We have a sound system and lights. We have a band. I think the band dominates, right? We have you. We gather really well for the most part. But we have a hard time when we scatter, I think. When we try to live in community, when we try to live on mission, when we try to live like salt and clusters, all, I would argue we are not horrible or anything, but we are weak on that one, which means we need to grow, my friends, and we need to change. And whenever you compare your life or your church to the teachings of Jesus and to Jesus' vision, and where there's no sync, where it does not line up, you make changes. Now that said, we feel like God is calling Solid Rock to make three changes. And before I outline that, to clarify, when I say we feel like God, I don't mean we, the leaders, are going to boss you around and you are going to obey. Doesn't work anyway. You're Americans. You're like, forget you, right? God bless you. But what I mean by we is we. Church leaders, elders, whatever, job is to, when you read the scriptures, listen to God, read the scriptures, pray, listen to what God is doing in one another and other churches and contexts like Portland around the world, what Jesus is up to, and listen to you, listen to God's people, listen to what God is doing in your life, your family, your house churches, your neighborhoods, what God is stirring in your heart. Put two and two together, confirm, correct. My job as the lead pastor is to get out in front, along with the other leaders, to get out in front of the church, look at where Solid Rock is at right now, the present, look at where Jesus is calling Solid Rock to step into in the future, and connect the dots and tie together all the micro visions, your vision, your house church's vision, what God is stirring in you into one macro vision, Jesus' vision, and to get my eyes and your eyes up onto the horizon to realize, wow, look what Jesus is doing, not only in your life, not only in my life, but in the people to your right and left and all around you and all over the city and all over the world. Look what Jesus is calling the church to step into. That's how leadership in theory should function. Now, that said, here is what we feel after listening to God and listening to God's people, like God is calling Solid Rock to step into. Three changes up on the screens, or if you are taking notes. First off, from come to us to go to them. Secondly, from house churches that function like small groups to missional communities. If you have no idea what that means, neither do I, but I will figure it out by next week when I teach on it. From a church, number three, with house churches to a church of house churches. Now, we are going to take the next 3 weeks and talk about all three changes and how we do church one at a time. Next week, we are going to talk about from house churches that function like small groups to missional communities, and think about Abraham and blessed to be a blessing, and think about Israel, and think about how the point of a house church should not be a house church. The point of a house church should not be relationships, community, do life, I know your name, you make me meals when I'm pregnant or whatever. But nothing wrong with any of that. The point should be the mission of God, a community formed around the mission of God. And we do all of that same stuff. Relationships, community, you're sick, you need a meal, clean your house, help out, life together, friendships, on the way to the mission of God, where you live or what God is stirring up in your heart. More on that next week. And 2 weeks from now, we're going to talk about from a church with house churches to a church of house churches. The hope and prayer for the next 2 or 3 years, I think it's going to take about 2 or 3 years to turn the ship called Solid Rock, but the hope is to go from 50 or 60 house churches to 500 or 600. Tons of you, I have no clue how many of you are not in a house church. It's okay, no guilt trip, but we want that to change. And for the most part, we want you to start one. Well, I could never. Yes, you could. and we're going to re-architect how churches function and smaller and all more organic, all of that. But we want to move from a church with house churches to of house churches, where we really are a network of house churches, meaning where you see your primary expression of church is not 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning at the West Side. Your primary expression is you and your friends, your neighbors, your 10, 20 people who make up your house church in a living room, in your front yard, cycling on a Saturday morning, wherever you do life. That is your primary expression of church. And you come together here on the weekends to absolutely celebrate what Jesus has been doing all week long. We really are not going to change much of anything in the weekends and how we gather, the light part, but we really feel God is calling us to re-architect how we scatter in house churches out into the city. You're going to hear a ton about house churches in the next 3 weeks, the next 3 months. Until you are like sick and tired, you're going to hear about what it looks like to live in community on mission. That's why the Sermon on the Mount, because it's all about relationships. 99% of the Sermon on the Mount is about community, how we live as disciples of Jesus in relationships. Now, that said, today, before we go, I want to talk about the first change from come to us to go to them, because it comes right out of Matthew 5. It comes right out of Jesus' metaphors, salt and light. Now, let me unpack what we mean by the change from come to us to go to them. And in one sense, it's not really a change. If you have been around for any length of time, you're like, aren't we already doing that? Yes, kind of, but we need to go on record, right? The change is, here's what we mean. Come to us churches, and if you go to Multnomah or Seminary, you're taking an ecclesiology class or talk church theory, come to us churches are called attractional churches. You don't need to write that down or anything. But in come to us churches or attractional churches, the goal is to attract people. The goal is to get as many people who are not followers of Jesus inside the walls of the church building and to attract people in, use the gospel, use free parking, free coffee, giveaways, whatever, but at any cost, get people in and expose people to the gospel through one dude up on the stage. And your job in an attractional church is to smile, help out greeting at the front door, work in the children's ministry, invite your friends and family, and put money in the offering bowl to make it all happen, right? Now, that's not all bad. Lots of you are here because of an attractional church, because one of your friends said, hey, I go to church. Do you want to come this weekend? And you said, okay, why not? And you were exposed to the gospel, and you were exposed to the church of disciples around the gospel. And you said, yeah, I'm in. I'm up for what God made me and intended me to walk into. It's not all bad, but when it's the only way you do church, at best, it's half of the story, at best. And as America shifts, as society moves from a Christian society, whatever that means in the West, to a post-Christian society, and I don't really get that. People all over talk about how Portland is an example of post-Christian America. I'm like, when were we ever Christian? Like, what Portland do you live in? Like, when were we ever, people pray for a revival in Portland. I'm like, I pray for a Bible. Right? When were we ever Christian? I don't know. I was not there for that part, right? But whatever. The point is, and here's where I agree, the church and the gospel are no longer at the center of Western society, but more and more, year by year, are off to the side, out in the margins. By the way, I think that can be a healthy thing. I think that can be healthy for the gospel in the world. But as America shifts, there are more and more and more people who will not set foot inside the walls of a church. Some of your friends will. You invite some of your friends, family, hey, let's go and talk about Jesus and the gospel. Some people are all in. Others give you a specific finger. Not the good one, right? There are more and more people who will not set foot inside the wall. You are the church to those people. You are the gospel of Jesus to those people, which is why there's another way of doing church. And it's called kind of the go-to-them mentality. In church theory, it's called missional or missional incarnational, and that makes you sound smart. I have no idea how to spell that, but I get the idea, and we're going to talk about those words in the coming weeks. Missional means you join in the mission of God and you push out to not come in, but go out. Incarnational means you push down like Jesus, who does not stay in a building and invite people to come listen, But Jesus goes, he does that from time to time, but then he goes out, he takes on flesh and blood, he incarnates, where we get the word incarnational, he incarnates, he lives shoulder to shoulder with people who are far from God. He loves people, serves people, and out of that, shares the gospel with people. He's not a dude up on a stage, he's a human right in front of your face. And Jesus becomes the model. Now, in a go-to-them church or a missional church, the goal, and listen, is to get as many of you as possible outside the walls of the church and to expose as many people as possible to the gospel of Jesus, not only through one dude up on stage, but through thousands of disciples of Jesus all over the city, in neighborhoods and homes and coffee shops and parks and gyms and cubicle centers and out into to spread out like the salt of the earth and to expose as many people as possible to the gospel of Jesus by your words and by your deeds. Now, it's a both and, would you agree? Like, should we invite friends and family to church? And should you preach the gospel? Or should we build relationships with people who don't know Jesus and love people and serve people and out of that share the, which one? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why not? Both and, as long as it's really both and. But it's way easier to do church on 2 hours every weekend than to live the gospel the other 166 hours of the week. Would you agree? Trust me, I preach for a living. Preaching the gospel to a crowd is easy. Sharing Jesus with my next door neighbor scares my pants off, right? Like what you guys do every single day when you interact with people at Intel and Nike and your neighborhoods and your schools who do not know Jesus, trust me, is way harder than when myself or whoever gets up here and preaches the gospel. Way harder, hands down, no questions. Both and, as long as it's really both and. What would it look like to live as Solid Rock like the salt of the earth and the light of the world? To spread out into the city, scattered in clusters of missionary people called house churches, and then on the weekends to gather together in orbit around Jesus like the light of the world. It would look like Jesus. Now, we're about done, but before we wrap up, I want you to know that the things we are going to talk about, the changes we are in process on, are not theory for me. It's not like I read books, and I read a ton, but it's not like I read books and like, wow, missional, incarnational, interesting, right? But it's born out of my story in my life. Here's my story in 5 minutes, right? I became a pastor at 19 years old. What was I thinking, right? Or better said, what was the guy who brought me on staff thinking, right? But 19 years old, and I absolutely love my job. I mean, I absolutely love, you are an amazing church to love and serve. But the downside to working with followers of Jesus is working with followers of Jesus, right? And by that, I don't mean that like in a critical negative way. Followers of Jesus are the most humble, life-giving, selfless, kind, joyous people I know. The problem is I am with followers of Jesus 24/7. 6 days a week, all day long. My job, my life is followers of Jesus. And as much as I love followers of Jesus, that's a problem when Jesus is a missionary to people who are not followers of Jesus. And if you're not a missionary, you're not a follower of Jesus. Because Jesus is not only in here, he's out there. You are all a missionary people. If you are a learner or an apprentice to Jesus, you by definition are a missionary somewhere. And we're going to talk about that word next week, sent by God out into the world. Now, it's a problem for me because I work with a bunch of people who know Jesus for the most part. I pray for Jose. But other than that, I work with people who know Jesus. And it's really easy when you work at a church to get sucked into the subculture you preach against. To get sucked into a world where all of your relationships, all of your friendships are with believers. Now, we planted the church 7 years ago with a team. Lots of you were in that team. Amazing journey. And when we planted the church, my wife and I were living downtown in the Pearl District. We really, as you know, love the city, have a heart for the urban core in the city. And we're living downtown, feeling like God was calling us to plant a church downtown, which did not happen for like 6 years. But long story, you know that. And after a few years, the church was out here in Beaverton, Tigard, exploding, and we really feel like the leaders should live with the people, right, to love you and to serve you. And we said, okay, we need to move out to the west side, and we put everything in a U-Haul and moved out, bought a house in Beaverton in Cedar Hills, kind of a 1960s ranch fixer-upper, did a remodel, and out of that came... out of that, about 3 years later, we kind of finished up the remodel, and we put the house up for sale, ready to move on. Downtown was on the horizon, ready to move back into Portland. And we realized, as the house was on the market, we realized one day that we had failed when it comes to really living the gospel in our neighborhood. We woke up one day and realized that all of our friends are believers, all of our relationships are with believers. And in 3 years in that neighborhood, we did not make any meaningful relationships. As far as I know, we did not share the gospel with one neighbor. I don't really know how we were a blessing to the neighborhood. I don't know that we did anything to love or to serve the neighborhood, much less share the gospel. Out of that, because I was really busy with church. I was really busy, I mean, with the weekends and thousands of people and stuff to do. I mean, I was working crazy, insane hours and coming home dead tired, garage door up, drive in, garage door down. Hope the neighbor who talks too much doesn't put his trash can out at the same time, right? Because I'm tired. I have been with people all day long, all so on and so forth. And we realize we flat out failed. And that's a problem because as the leaders go, so goes the church, right? We cannot ask you to do anything we are not willing to do ourselves. We cannot, you know, sell anything we're not willing to smoke, for lack of a better analogy. Let's cut that from the podcast. Right? But, I mean, really, we cannot ask you to do anything we are not willing to do ourselves. We cannot ask you to get into house churches and live as a missionary people to your neighborhoods if we are not in house churches living as a missionary people to neighborhoods. Am I right? And if everybody was living like my wife and I, we would have a serious problem on our hands. And we realized we failed. And so here's the plan. So house sells in like a few days, crazy, and we start to pray. And we're looking for a new house, kind of in transition, and we're looking for a new neighborhood, and we say, Jesus, please lead us to the right house, the right neighborhood, and the right open doors for the gospel. And crazy thing, turns out Jesus answers prayer. What a novel concept, right? And we move into a neighborhood, crazy story, another remodel, right? But move into a crazy, great, very Portland neighborhood. I don't mean that in the positive sense of Portland, right? Like nobody knows Jesus at all, as far as I'm aware. And from day one, God opens up door after door after door after door for us to build relationships and love and serve and open up the home. And it invigorates my walk with God. It invigorates my marriage, my family. It changes. The gospel changes your life when you agree. It does not only change your future, where you end up when you die. Yeah, absolutely. But if you really encounter Jesus and you really encounter the gospel, it changes how you live 24/7. And the gospel, as we form our family and our house around the gospel, not only the church, but the gospel, it starts to reorient and reshape how we live and walk with Jesus, how we operate, how we spend time, how we spend money, relationships, friendships, all of that. Well, about 6 months in, we realized, gosh, We need a house church here. We need to do this, but not by ourselves. We need to do this in community. We need people. We need accountability. Not like only, you know, did you not watch a bad movie, but like, did you talk to your neighbor about Jesus? Yes or no, right? We need help to spur one another on in the language of Hebrews. We start praying for God to help bring people to faith or start a house church in our neighborhood. And one of my good friends, Matt Norman and his wife, Anna, who he's one of the new elders here and goes downtown, lives downtown, were going in the process of buying a house in North Portland because she's pregnant, baby number one, time for a house, all that. In process, buying a really great, you know, house in North Portland. And I say, hey, you know, you have 2 seconds really fast. Like, yeah. And I'm like, hey, I think you should not buy the house in North Portland. I think you should move into my neighborhood in Southwest Portland, and we should start a house church together. Will you pray about that? Right? Because it doesn't cost me a dime for him to move into my neighborhood, right? It's like, here's a flower pot. Welcome to the neighborhood, right? And I'm like, and he's like, well, I mean, okay. He prays, he comes back, he's like, well, yeah, I may be into that. And long story short, he closed on a house 2 weeks ago, one house over from me, right? Ladies and gentlemen, Jesus now lives in my neighborhood, right? And the plan is to do life together. Not simply like every other Thursday night, but life together. Everything from grocery shopping to prayer, from Saturday morning runs to the scriptures and the gospel. Life together in community around mission. The point of that house church will not be that house church. It will be to love and serve and share the gospel with people where I live. And for me, it has been invigorating in my walk with God. And all I'm doing is catching up to what hundreds of you are already at work. Lots of you are like, yeah, I get all of that. I know you're better than I am. I'm sorry. But I'm living proof you can succeed as a pastor and fail as a missionary. And I'm on the edge of my seat to see what God does as myself and hundreds or thousands of you step into community and into a community where the point is not the community, but the point is the mission of God. There are two, we have a class here called Church and Mission. That is for people who are new to the church. If you are new to Solid Rock, please go through the class. It's 4 weeks long on Sunday mornings for an hour. I think it's going on actually right now as we speak or next hour. I don't know. And I should know, but I don't. I'm sorry. But on the first class, the first day, here's what we tell you if you are new to the church. We say there are two different ways of thinking about the church. One is to think about the church like a movie theater. And I know the analogy is tired, but it makes sense, right? You come in, you sit down, there's a stage up front, you watch, there's lights, sound, music, action, all of that. You put money in the bowls to kind of, you know, pay for religious goods and services. Right after it's over, you are back out the door, get into the parking lot, beat everybody out. Right? Because, I mean, at a movie theater, when was the last time you go to a movie and when it's done and the credits roll, you turn to the person next to you, where are you from, man? What's your life? How are you really doing? Right? You want to go out to brunch and talk about Jesus and the gospel? Like, no, credits roll, you are out the back door, first one out of the parking lot, right? I'm like, I'm the dude, I'm super impatient. I'm like, I know the movie's winding down. I go stand by the exit and watch the movie from the exit, and it's like, goes black, boom, I'm out, right? Like, and you do all of that, and on the way out, you got to brunch, you got to lunch, what have you, and you ask questions like, you know, how did you like it? What do you think? You like that part? Yes, no. Who's your favorite personality, right? Did you like, wait, are we talking about a movie or are we talking about church? Yes. And that is one way of thinking about church, in particular, the weekend gatherings. Another way of thinking about the church, and I know it is not hip at all or urban or any of that, but another way of thinking about the church is like Home Depot. Brilliant, I know. Like, where does he come up with that genius? I know, I'm sorry. Home Depot. Anybody know what Home Depot's slogan is? Okay, wait, what? You're home away from home? Nope, wrong. I'm sorry. God bless you. What? Anybody know Home Depot's slogan? Yes, thank you. Some dude in the back row, I'm like a man, tool man. You can do it. We can help. Now, here's how Home Depot functions. Half of you dudes are like, I like church now, right? Right, here's how Home Depot functions. You have a project. You need to tile your bathroom or recarpet your living room or put pergo down in your kitchen, right? Or plant an urban garden or whatever, right? And you go to Home Depot with a project in mind, and it's a resourcing center. And you walk into a massive warehouse building, and you go back. If you're going to tile your bathroom, you go to the tile section, and everything you need is right in one spot. And there is an expert there in tile. In theory. But for $7 an hour, you never know, right? But in theory, there's an expert in tile, and there's the tile that you need in options, and there's grout and colors, and there's a how-to book for $9.99, and he says, hey, there's a class Thursday night from 6:30 to 8 on how to tile your bathroom, and I will be here all weekend. If you need help, come back with any problems, any issues. I am here to help you. You put everything in the cart, you go back out the door, and you tile your bathroom to the glory of God. That, brothers and sisters, is what the church should function like, I would argue. You come here and you all have a project, you all have a mission, you all have something God is calling you to do. Now, half of you may not know what that is. You will soon. God is going to show you, I believe, in the coming weeks, as we lean into Jesus and listen, God is going to show you. But you have a project, you have a mission, you come here, we are a resourcing center. We are here to help you, serve you, train you, and push you back out into the city to work with Jesus. One of the central verses here is Ephesians 4, 11 and 12, where Paul says, God gave some, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, right, i.e. church leaders, for, here's the function of church leaders, and I quote, and the older versions have the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry. The newer ones like mine have to prepare God's people for works of service. Meaning, my job, I work here, right? My job is not to do ministry as much as to equip you to do ministry. Does that make sense? It's not, hey, you come in here, sit down, pay the professionals to do ministry. It's, hey, you come, gather, worship, give to the mission of God, and my job is to equip you. It's the other way around. It's backwards or right side up from how lots of people think. My job is to prepare you for works of service, to join Jesus in loving and serving and sharing the gospel with the city. My job is to prepare you, equip you, teach you, train you, and kick you back out the door, and to release you into the city. And that is my hope and prayer, that myself and the leaders here would function as equippers, servants, who simply are here to push you in love back out into the city to be the light of the world and the salt of the earth. One of my favorite verses in the scriptures is 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, and the words are up here on the screens. Peter, who was there at the Sermon on the Mount, rephrases Jesus, and he says, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world," Israel language, "to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul," stuff that's holding you back from God's calling on your life to be a blessing. "Live such good lives among the pagans," right? Among the pagans, not a derogatory term in the Bible, shoulder to shoulder, right in relationships with people who do not know God, "that though they accuse you of doing wrong," though the gospel gets a bad rap in society right now, though the church is off to the side, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your what? Your good deeds, not your t-shirts, not your bumper stickers, not your radios, your good deeds, how you actually live, and glorify God on the day he visits us. Live in God's presence when Jesus returns. That, brothers and sisters, is the mission of every church, every house church, every disciple of Jesus. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. And all of that happens outside these walls. Would you agree? For the next few weeks, there are going to be signs by the exits that say in massive black letters, "Church starts now." And don't get me wrong, you are at church, but you are about to go live out church on the streets of the city. May you, brothers and sisters, live as the salt of the earth and the light of the world.